Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. How's everyone doing today?
Doing pretty well, yeah.
I'm good, too. And also, Adrian Beltre just got his 3,000th career hit, so that's cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
Awesome.
I love him.
He is so fantastic. Which leads us to our first topic today. Adrian Beltre was ejected from a game this past week for moving the on-deck circle. Beltre was taking hacks to the left of the on-deck circle, and when asked to get in the circle by crew chief umpire Jerry Davis, he physically dragged the on-deck circle to where he wanted it to be and was subsequently ejected. Do you guys think that Beltre's ejection was warranted at all?
First, I want to say that I did not know that you could just, like, pick up on-deck circles and move them. But apparently I'm the only person in the world who didn't know this, as all of my followers pointed out. So thanks for that, guys. Secondly, I think that it was obviously an insanely amusing situation. But I think that it was probably a warranted ejection. Umpires do have the discretion to tell players to get in the on-deck circle when they think that they're too close to home plate and they might get hit by a foul ball or something like that. So I do think that he probably should have been ejected for this, but it was great nonetheless.
Yeah, I think that's a fair argument. But I have also seen the argument made that, you know, while there is technically a rule that you are supposed to stand in the on-deck circle, actually it was Michael Young who noted on Twitter that the circle itself is pretty slippery, and so batters don't actually like to stand, like, right on it. And if you watch a game, you'll notice that few batters actually do. So it seems like the umpire, it is kind of a matter of umpires picking and choosing when they want to actually enforce this. And I don't know that Adrian Beltre is the guy you want to be making an example out of. Like, yeah, he did kind of show the umpire up a little by doing that. But at the same time, I don't know. It was funny. It didn't seem like that big of a deal. I think it was a little bit of an ump show on the part of Jerry Davis. But it's, you know, at the end of the day, it probably isn't that big of a deal either way. It's really funny either way, and it's probably the funniest thing I've ever seen anybody get ejected for.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I, working in baseball, like, I've stepped on deck circles and they are pretty slippery. But I also get Jerry Davis' concern for, you know, maybe a ball flying out and hitting Beltre, which I get is a concern, especially if you're closer to behind home plate than the on deck circle. But at the same time, I mean, anyone could get hit from anywhere on the field. So it just kind of seems like there's a lot of flawed arguments why Jerry Davis, you know, ejected Beltre. But at the same time, like, I get why he was ejected, but I don't think he should have been ejected for that, just because of the absurdity of it all. Outside of Beltre, what are the best or most absurd reasons for ejections that we've seen or heard about?
I think we kind of have to start off with George Brett's ejection for the pine tar.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty classic one that most baseball fans have probably either heard about or actually seen the video of. And it's pretty great. He just kind of goes absolutely insane, which is always hilarious.
Yeah, that's one worth seeking out video for anyone who hasn't watched that. Another example that it's before all of our times, but in 1980, when Rick Honeycutt was with the Royals, he was caught illegally doctoring a baseball with a thumbtack. He, I guess, taped a thumbtack to his finger on his glove hand, which he then used to scuff up the ball, although he himself noted that he didn't do so very effectively. And at some point, he I guess, forgot the thumbtack was there. He removed his glove to wipe the sweat from his brow, and he ended up cutting his forehead. And that's how he got caught with the thumbtack taped to his finger, which, you know, ouch, and also not very smart. He ended up being ejected for that, obviously, and he was also suspended for 10 days and fined $500, which seems like nothing now, but would have been a bit more at the time. According to the LA Times article that I read about it from 1987, he was the first pitcher ever caught illegally doctoring a baseball while on the mound. And that's quite a way of going about it.
What do you guys think of that minor league manager who got ejected and then just did, like, bizarre things, like creeping up on the pitching mound and stuff like that?
Was that the same one who did the army crawl?
Yeah.
Yes. I feel like there's less repercussions in minor league baseball just because it doesn't have the same impact on a major league team. That being said, I feel that the minor leagues have seen a number of bizarre ejections, which the one that I was going to bring up for the most absurd one that I've ever seen was actually one that I saw in person in 2010, which ended up being Madison Bumgarner's, like, second to last start in AAA. So there were two calls at second base for stolen bases that were very close, and Bumgarner thought that they got both of them out, and after the second one, he just completely blew up and charged the ump. And he had to be physically restrained by Eugenio Velez, and then he got ejected because, of course, you're going to get ejected for charging the ump. And then he went to the dugout and then threw the game ball into the outfield. So it's a very Madison Bumgarner story. But it also kind of goes to show how minor leagues are very weird. I've also heard stories of just the most bizarre ejections. And I don't know if there's any minor league manager ejection that tops the army crawl throwing bases one.
Yeah, I feel like MLB managers should probably be taking notes. Like, if you've already been kicked out of a game, then might as well, you know, they always say, like, always getting his money's worth. But, like, just yelling at an umpire, that's not really getting your money's worth. You gotta, like, go all out.
Yeah. I guess as much as I'm not a fan of that guy, we probably have to talk about Bobby Valentine's mustache. Because I thought that was pretty creative to come up with that, and pretty daring.
Yeah, that was a good one. There's a list on Bleacher Report from 2011 that actually does power rankings for the 25 best MLB manager ejections of all time as of, you know, 2011 with video. And it also lists, like, any of Billy Martin's ejections, a lot of different Mike Scioscia ejections, Bobby Valentine. So I feel like it's a pretty good comprehensive list of ejections.
Well, on the subject of weird things that happen in baseball this week, I don't know if either of you probably weren't watching live, but there was an 18-minute delay in the Twins-Dodgers game for kind of a weird reason. So the Twins manager, Paul Molitor, decided to make a double switch. And, you know, being in the American League, he, I guess, is not used to making double switches all that often, which, you know, makes sense. You have the designated hitter. It's not something that's called for much of the time. Or at least certainly not as often as it is in the National League. So it's a little bit hard to explain what happened, so I'm going to defer to the Twin Cities Pioneer Press here. Basically, Molitor wanted to replace right-hander Trevor Hildenberg with Ryan Pressly, who would bat seventh in Jorge Polanco's spot. Ere Adrianza would bat ninth and play shortstop for Polanco. Home plate umpire Ted Barrett notified the Dodgers bench, but after Pressly threw his first pitch, Dave Roberts wanted to challenge the double switch. After Molitor first visited Barrett, the umpire marked Matt Belisle's name on his official lineup card in Eddie Rosario's spot, fifth. Belisle warmed up in the Twins' bullpen earlier in the game but never appeared. "I don't know if I said a wrong name," Molitor said. "I can't imagine I said Belisle for Rosario, but he heard what he heard. I probably should have watched to make sure he marked his card correctly. I marked mine correctly. Somehow it wasn't clear to him what I wanted to do." So does this whole debacle suggest that there is something wrong with the current system of subbing in players?
I don't know. It might, but it also seems like pretty anomalous. Like something like this wouldn't happen that frequently. And it is really just kind of a freak error, either by Molitor or by the umpire, like somebody like misheard something or like misspoke. So I don't know if it really denotes an issue with the current system or just kind of like an issue with somebody's hearing.
Go ahead, Jen.
No, I was just gonna say that yeah, it's very much rare to see a double switch error like that, but at the same time, I can get it from an AL team's point of view because they don't have to do it that often. That, you know, the double switch isn't utilized so much in the American League, and while it's normal in the National League to have double switches, a manager who might not have had experience managing a National League team or a team without a DH, you know, might not have that same experience. So I think really it's just maybe, you know, explaining the double switch a little better.
Yeah, I think generally speaking, for every, I don't know, 999 times that someone makes, sorry, let me start that over. So for every like 1,000 times that, you know, a double switch is made, like 999 times out of 1,000, it goes correctly. Like something like this, I've never seen anything like this before. I mean, there are certainly issues that have arisen with, you know, substitutions being made, and they're often not caught. This actually got caught because of the Dodgers bench coach Bob Guerin. He was paying really close attention, had his rule book in hand, and, you know, he's the one who pushed Dave Roberts to go out and say something about it. But yeah, just overall, it's not something that's an issue the majority of the time. So I don't think this is the sort of thing that merits any sort of serious change. Just, I don't know, and if you're Paul Molitor or whoever, you gotta look at the umpire's card and make sure that he takes down what you actually wanted him to take down, as Molitor himself noted.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like Molitor was trying to game the system or anything.
Yeah, I feel like it was just kind of an error of carelessness.
Well, do either of you think that this is an argument for or against the DH in both leagues, or an argument for or against interleague play?
I don't think it's necessarily an argument for the DH or, you know, against interleague play. I think it's just that rule books sometimes need to be interpreted to managers a little better, especially since the language in the rule book can seem like legalese. Just kind of having a better understanding, especially going into an interleague series, would help a lot.
Yeah, I'll say I'm obviously quite pro DH, but I don't think this one instance is an argument for or against the DH. But I'm just gonna go out on a limb and say that it's an argument against interleague play being played this late in the season. I really liked it when it was all just kind of in June and everybody was doing it at the same time and everybody was just thinking, oh, like, this is kind of weird and interesting, but sure, we'll try it out as a group. I think once you get to this part of the season, people are just kind of so focused on their own divisions and their own leagues that it's probably best just to take out interleague once you get this late to the season, once you get around the deadline, and just kind of focus on your own divisional play as opposed to trying to do something that you're not really used to doing at this point in the season, even though these guys probably should be aware of the rules and should be more ardent in their application of the rules than they are. But again, I don't think you can really use like one instance to say that this is why the DH should exist everywhere, although it should.
I agree with everything except for the DH being used everywhere. I was just gonna say that, you know, if there's multiple instances of this, then maybe, you know, consideration for some change. But because it's an isolated incident, I don't think an argument could be made using this case alone.
Yeah, I think at best it's a cautionary tale for other AL managers, particularly those who don't have any NL coaching or managing experience, to just better prep heading into interleague series. I agree that it's something that is extremely unusual and shouldn't actually be considered as evidence that any major rule changes need to be implemented in either league or throughout baseball as a whole.
Yeah, definitely agreed. So we're coming in on the trade deadline. By the time this podcast is released, it's probably going to be at the trade deadline itself. But in the past week, there haven't been that many blockbuster trades, a lot of different relievers on the move, including but not limited to Steve Cishek, Sergio Romo and Dan Jennings to the Rays, Anthony Swarzak to the Brewers, Pat Neshek to the Rockies, and then there's AJ Ramos to the Mets, and then there's Jaime Garcia to the Yankees after just one start with the Twins, and then Howie Kendrick to the Nationals, Lucas Duda to the Rays, Jeremy Hellickson to the Orioles, Eduardo Nunez to the Red Sox, just a lot of different trades. It's mostly a lot of small moving pieces, but it seems like they're just kind of trying to see what they can get for their teams and make a run for either the division or wild cards.
Yeah, I think it's not really surprising that it's mostly been relievers on the move, because I think that the starter market is just so bizarre that it was probably guaranteed that you're not going to see a lot of that. And I also think, especially with last season's playoffs, people are now realizing, or at least teams are now realizing, the importance of getting quality relievers for the playoffs, especially with teams like the Nationals and those in contention, really who could really use more help in their bullpens coming into the home stretch of the season. So I don't think that that's really a surprise at all.
Yeah, I think a lot of teams don't want to be the 2016 Giants, and I completely understand why they don't want to be that. I say this after having been at one of the NLDS games last year between the Giants and the Cubs, where both bullpens blew the game and went into like 13 innings. So it makes sense that the Nationals are, you know, looking for relievers. The Rays are looking for relievers. Rockies, they went from having like the best WAR by Fangraphs standards from in month of April to having the worst in July. So they desperately want bullpen help if they want to make a run for the wild card. So it's just a lot of value in relievers, and it's definitely a reliever market, but there are still teams looking for starting pitchers. It's just that there's not a lot of starting pitchers on the trade block.
I will say that I'm a little surprised the Nationals haven't done more vis-a-vis their bullpen. They, you know, made the trade to acquire Madsen and Doolittle, and obviously that made them better, but I don't know that it's enough. It surprised me that with all the, you know, fairly minor transactions going on with relievers, you know, and the price not being that high for most of them, it kind of is surprising to me that the Nationals haven't made a couple more moves there, but they still have a couple more days, so something could happen. But yeah, to this point, that has been probably the, because it seems like a fairly simple fix, and I'm not quite sure why they haven't gone for it to this point.
Yeah, I don't know if they're like waiting for the market to settle a little and for maybe teams who are sellers to lower their price a little once it gets closer to the deadline, and they might act then and acquire at least another reliever.
Yeah, or someone might show up on the waiver wire in August, and that might be the way that they go. But Mary, because you're a Red Sox fan and I am a Giants fan, what do you think of Eduardo Nunez to the Red Sox for right-handed pitchers Gregory Santos and Sean Anderson?
I think that a lot of Red Sox fans were initially very confused by the trade. I think that we were probably looking to acquire more of a starting third baseman, if anything. And we have a lot of like backup infielders and outfielders already, especially with Brock Holt, who's basically can play the same positions as Nunez. But obviously the offense has been lacking for basically the entire season. So I think that's kind of the attraction to Nunez, although I think is his defense like basically non-existent?
No, he's actually a fairly good defender. One of the reasons why the Giants traded for him last year was not only because they traded Matt Duffy, but he was a fairly good defender and had hits for average. Not exactly like stellar gold glove infielder, but, you know, he can make a lot of plays and turn routine double plays and things like that. But it's not like he's Brandon Crawford or anything. He was just a serviceable left side of the infield guy.
Right. I mean, I can't really knock him so far. He's done pretty well offensively for the Red Sox, although it hasn't really paid off yet. But yeah, I think it'll just be interesting. I was kind of sad to see them send Marrero down, just because I think that he definitely showcased how great defensively he is. But I think it might be a decent trade-off if Nunez continues. Well, I mean, he can probably regress a little because he's hitting like 500 so far. But if he continues to show up offensively, I think that can definitely offset any sort of minor fielding differences there might be between him and Marrero.
Yeah, definitely. And from the Giants' standpoint, I know that, you know, they have at least journeyman AAA guys who can fill in for third base in the meantime. So Nunez was expendable, and I know that they're trying to get pitching back, hence why they traded for Santos and Anderson. And Anderson made his Giants organizational debut last night with San Jose Giants versus Lancaster Jethawks, and went 3.1 innings, giving up 5 runs. Although there is the Lancaster effect because they play in a ballpark that's like 4,000 feet high and has 25 mile an hour winds. So maybe not the best place for him to start. But I think it just makes sense from the Giants' standpoint to try and get rid of guys who they didn't get for cheaper cheap from, you know, signing them to extensions like Brandon Crawford, Brandon Belt, Buster Posey. I mean, they're not going to get rid of any of those guys, but they're trying to get rid of what they can so that they can do a partial rebuild, because we all know that the Giants are not going to do a full rebuild, especially not having players like Crawford and Belt and Posey on their team.
Yeah, yeah, that definitely makes sense for the Giants. So I think it's probably another trade where teams got what they were looking for out of it. So what do you guys have any other predictions for the trade deadline? Do you guys say, for instance, do you guys have any idea where Sonny Gray might end up, or if he's going to be kind of another name that gets tossed around by everyone, but nobody actually pulls the trigger and acquires him?
I think someone is going to acquire him. It's just a matter of who. I think he's going to go to a National League team. I just don't know which division. I would not be surprised if he goes to the Dodgers. I would not be surprised if he goes to the Nationals. I would be surprised if he goes to the Yankees.
Yeah, I was kind of expecting him to go to the Yankees because it seemed like a good fit in a number of ways, but they just traded for Jaime Garcia, so I guess there isn't quite as much of a need for him there now. I would be pretty cool with him going to the Dodgers from the Dodger fan perspective, but at this point I'm kind of resigned to them not doing anything major for this particular deadline. And I think I'm okay with that because there's not really any big changes that they need to make. They have enough depth basically everywhere that, you know, while it might have been nice to get a, you know, solid left-handed reliever, or, you know, there's an argument to be made for having another starter for, you know, a really solid playoff rotation. I don't think any of those are needs, and this Dodger team is looking like as dominant as probably any I've ever seen. So, you know, I'm sure now that I've said this, they're going to, you know, make a big trade, like, as soon as we stop recording. But, yeah, at this point, I have basically made my peace with the fact that I don't think they're going to pull off anything big at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I could see the Red Sox acquiring another starter with the Price injury, because Dombrowski said that he's confident that at some point this season, Price will be back to pitch for the Red Sox, but that doesn't sound super great. But I don't know who they'd be in the market to get, and I think they'd have to move major league pieces to do it. Dombrowski, I mean, again, this like probably doesn't mean like a whole lot coming from him, but he said that he's pretty much done moving major minor league pieces, minor league players. I'll stop calling them pieces. They're human beings. So I don't know. I could see them going after another starter, but I, again, wouldn't be surprised if they didn't do that.
Yeah. Do you guys think that Yu Darvish is going to be moved by the deadline?
Maybe. I can't say that. That's my answer.
I think there's a possibility, but it would take a lot to get him, and I don't know if teams have what the Rangers would be looking for, especially since the Rangers were a team that were so in contention for the last few years that they traded away a lot of minor leaguers to get like Cole Hamels, and now it's at the point where it's like, okay, we might have to do a rebuild because the Astros are just completely soaring and the Mariners are kind of on the up and up. So it's probably going to be a high price for Darvish. It's just going to be a matter of if other teams have what they're asking for. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, then Darvish is probably going to stay put and they might trade him in the offseason.
Mm-hmm. And that's probably can go for Verlander as well. And I think that he might be more of a gamble than Darvish for teams as well. since he's having a down year and is fairly old now. How old is he?
I'm gonna say like 34.
Yeah, somewhere around there. Yeah, he's 34.
Yeah.
Just looked at that job.
All right, good job, me. I don't know why I knew that, but I knew that.
You just said you know that. It's great. I love it.
Just
players, you can throw out their ages, and we'll see how close you can get.
This is a game for another time, I think. But I'm down. I'm probably going to be terrible at it now that I've bragged about this. But on the sub, going back to Darvish really fast. I think just to note, he will be a free agent after this season.
Yeah.
But
completely forgot about that.
Yeah. So if obviously that, yeah. So if the Rangers are going to trade him, then this would be the time to do it. And yeah, I'm sure they're listening in on everything that they are getting. I agree that, you know, a lot of teams probably aren't going to be willing to put up the price that he commands. But I don't know, maybe it's one of those things where if the Rangers get desperate enough, then they'll go ahead and say, okay, we're willing to take less than we would otherwise, because what do they have to lose? It's, you know, 2 months of you, Darvish.
Didn't they say that if they trade him, they're confident that he will re-sign with them in the offseason? Or did I make that up?
Sounds familiar, but I don't know.
It does sound familiar.
Okay, we'll go with it. It definitely
and does. I think because Sonny Gray is under team control until 2020, he'd be the bigger target for teams just because he's not a rental, and he's got a lower asking price. So I think it's all dependent on if teams want to spend big and get Darvish, or they want to be a little bit more conservative on the asking price and go for Sonny Gray. Or they could go for Justin Verlander, who is under contract until 2019, but he's having a down year and is worth a lot of money. But even in a down year, Justin Verlander is worth nearly 2 FWAR.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I think there are probably going to be maybe more moves. That's really sounding confident. In the AL, because teams are so bunched together, and you have two divisions that are still like fairly open, especially the AL East. So teams might be thinking that they can make more of a run in the AL than they can in the NL.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, the NL West and the NL East are both looking fairly sewn up at this point. You know, with the NL Central, there's still a legit race going on there. But, you know, I don't know that anyone expects that much of the Brewers. I think people are thinking that even though it's currently close, the Cubs probably have this in the bag more or less. But I don't know, I guess the Brewers could surprise us all and make a few trades to show that they're serious about contending this year.
What do you guys think of the Mets trade? Because I know that a lot of Mets fans were very taken aback and confused by it.
The Duda trade?
Yeah.
I was confused by it too.
Same. It seems like they did not get a lot back for him at all, and they probably could have gotten more back. So I think Mets fans have a right to be upset with this.
Yeah, it seems that the Mets were completely fleeced, and the Rays are, you know, trying to go for that wild card spot, and they have the potential to do that, but then, you know, the Mets just keep Metsing really hard. And not only that, they lost the fan favorite We Follow Lucas Duda account. So
yeah.
It got traded to the Rays as well. So the Mets took a really big L on this one.
Do you guys see the forget who had the headline, but it was like the Duda buys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Baseball Prospectus.
It was B-Pro, of course. I should have known.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that one was a pretty good headline. That it was one of those headlines that made me really mad because of how good it was.
Same. Same. Yeah,
well done, folks.
So moving on to Twitter questions. This one is from Corinne, who is at QuickPitch on Twitter. Which Gorky's is the real Gorky's? The horrible one at the beginning of the season, or the almost tolerable one this month? Looking at Gorky's stats over many, many years, I would have to say that the real Gorky's is the terrible one, unfortunately. He might have a little bit of a surge this month, but regression to the mean tells me that he is always going to be a negative WAR player with a very low ISO, not really low, but average-ish numbers. Otherwise, he's never going to walk a lot. He's going to strike out a little bit more. He's not going to really have high BABIP. So I just don't see him being able to keep this up.
Yeah, and it's rare that you see a player really develop once they reach, like, around the age of 30. Like, typically that happens, like, mid to late 20s.
Yeah. Like, Gorky's is just... There's a reason why when I write recaps for McCovey Chronicles and Gorky's Hernandez does something good, I put in a lot of question marks in parentheses.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that kind of sums up his career and his game in general. I don't think realistically his true talent level is as good as, you know, what his numbers are for this month. I don't think he's necessarily as bad, just based on what I've seen from him, as, you know, his numbers were to start the season, but I think that is definitely closer to what the real Gorky's is. So, yeah, if that's a disappointing answer, Corinne, I'm sorry about that.
Okay, to be fair, the Giants in general are disappointing, so it just kind of fits in line with the season.
Yeah, and I feel like much of his appeal is his name. Over his.
Which is a fantastic name.
It is, yeah. No, I can't knock him for that.
Yeah, there's, the pun potentials are limitless.
I am just upset that it's not attached to a player who can hit better and field better, but as is the Giants' 2017 season.
He might have like a son that grows up and he names him Gorky's 2 or Gorky's Jr. probably.
Gorky's 2, Electric Boogaloo.
That's a common thing. And he could be good, so there's still hope for the Gorky's name. It's going to be his middle name, by the way. So it's going to be Gorky's 2 Hernandez Jr., of course.
That's good. That's a good name. I think that he should definitely name a kid that. Thanks, Mary.
You're welcome.
So our next question is from AJ, who is at AJ on the guitar. I temporarily lost my sight this week, so I have to audio a few games. So best baseball sound. Brandon Morrow's fastball sounded glorious. First of all, I want to say I hope you're feeling better, AJ, and I hope that you get your sight back. I think I say that for all of us here. Second, my favorite baseball sound would probably be the sound of the ball hitting the catcher's mitt. It, for me, doesn't really matter who's throwing it, but just that sound is really soothing for some reason.
Yeah, I, for a similar reason, the sound of the crack of the bat when someone really gets a hold of one. Like, you know that scene, this is the second Big Lebowski reference of the day, but is that scene in the Big Lebowski where the dude is like meditating, listening to bowling sounds? I feel like I could do that, but with the sound of the crack of the bat. Like, you know, there's certain players who they say that it sounds different coming off their bat, and I think that's definitely true for, I don't know, like, I talk about Yasiel Puig a lot, but I think that's true in his case. You know, historically, guys like Babe Ruth or Josh Gibson are cited as having kind of a unique sound. So, yeah, that may be a stereotypical answer, but it's what I'm going with.
Yeah, those two are definitely the best. So I'm just going to throw out some other ones. I really love when the crowd is really synchronized, especially when there's a close play and they think that it goes one way, so they're all cheering, and then within the span of like half a second they switch to like gasps and then boos. I think that is really great. And I think that I love when you can hear an ump strike call. I think that's just really hilarious, because they're generally very different, but they're all just like, so great to me, especially when they're accompanied by sort of like weird actions or really emphatic motions for the third strike call especially. So those two are definitely up there on my list.
My less serious answer is going to be these grunts, because there's a number of pitchers out there who will grunt after they throw a pitch, but I don't think anyone is quite as loud and quite as consistent with it as Zach Greinke is. It, like, next time anyone listening to this is watching a Zach Greinke start, just listen for it. You can't miss it. It is so loud.
Yeah, that's a good one. Although I think Scherzer during the All-Star game could give Greinke maybe a run for his money, because he was really grunting.
Yeah, oh, Scherzer, like, grunts. He growls. Like, it makes sense. He loves animals. He's a big, like, he and his wife are big dog rescue people, so maybe he feels a kinship with them on that level. But yeah, he makes a lot of interesting noises and facial expressions when he's pitching.
Yeah, it is. It's really like a full sensory experience watching him pitch. Like, you get a little bit of everything. And you're both terrified and intrigued, so it's great.
Yeah, I think that sums up how I feel about Scherzer pretty well. Terrified, but intrigued.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So our final Twitter question is from Sochi, who is at Sochi44. Are acai bowls just fruit soup?
Yes.
You know, I've never had one, but they seem to be more like they're smoothies and bowls.
Yeah. I think you really have to like have the time, be dedicated to an acai bowl. Like, I'd rather just have something in a cup that I can like bring with me on the move.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't be good ballpark food then.
No. Like,
just to make this a baseball related question.
Yeah. I've never had one, and I can see the appeal of having it in a helmet cup, but I think a lot of people would say that it's not worth the price, but acai bowls are already expensive as it is, and so is ballpark food. But I can see, you know, a lot of fresh fruit smoothies being sold more at ballparks.
But they also, they would stain, like, if you spilled them.
Yeah.
Like, those fruits really, really do a number. So you'd have to be wearing, like, a dark shirt. Like, I guess, probably, like, the Yankees, the Red Sox, like, anybody with a dark blue color. Mm-hmm. That they use, like, primarily for their jerseys or whatever. Like, they could probably get away with it, but, like, you know, anybody else would probably have to go a different route.
If we were to gauge which baseball team would be the first to have an acai bowl stand, if there isn't already one, which one would we think it would be?
I mean, my mind goes right to the Dodgers.
Yeah, I think Yeah, I think they're the most, like, vegan-friendly ballpark in baseball, yeah. So that makes mm-hmm. sense.
Yeah, I was thinking it would probably be one of the California teams just because it's so big out here.
Yeah, and the Giants, I think, make sense for that reason, and also because they have probably the greatest variety of food available at any ballpark I've been to. So, you know, why not have an acai bowl stand as well?
Yeah, they did just start selling boba recently, which is fantastic. So, would not be surprised if they had acai bowls.
What team would be the least likely to sell them?
Cardinals.
I was going to say Cardinals, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They seem like an easy answer here just because they are the go-to team for, you know, what's traditional and, you know, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing or a neutral thing. I think we can agree that acai bowls in a ballpark is not a traditional thing and thus doesn't seem like a good fit for the Cardinals.
I could also see the Trop not selling them. Although unless they want to like try and bring in a younger crowd, they can be like, hey guys, we're hip. Like we have these acai bowls, like come to a game and eat them. But I just don't think they fit with the aesthetics of the Trop as it is right now. Nor with like the old people that live there, they probably would not go for one. They'd probably be very confused by the entire concept.
Yeah, I can definitely see that.
So glad we settled this.
Yeah, we spent a lot more time on this question than I thought we possibly could, so good job us.
So, I mean, really, just submit any questions and we can turn them into a full segment, guys.
And we can turn it into a baseball question.
Yes, more importantly, I guess, since it's a baseball podcast.
In theory.
Finally, I've caught on to what we're doing here, guys. I'm with you now.
So, moving on to the articles from this past week. Mary, you want to take it away?
Yep. So on Monday, Does Mixing Speeds of a Single Pitch Help Pitchers by Ryan Pollock. So Evan Longoria had one of those like top five hardest players to face or pitchers to face articles in the Players Tribune. And he listed Chris Sale as his number one because Sale varies the release speeds of individual pitches. So Ryan kind of investigates whether this skill actually makes pitchers better. So in order to do so, he examines starting pitchers from 2015 through this year who have thrown at least 300 of an individual pitch type. So he calculated the median absolute deviation, the MAD, within each pitch type, asserting that a higher MAD means more pitch speed variance. So if you want to find out whether this is actually a good thing for pitchers, go to hardballtimes.com and read this article. And he also has a lot of great charts that you should look at. They're very captivating. I spent a long time staring at them. So maybe like set aside like a good half hour to read this if you are like me and you love a good chart, and are also jealous of people who can make charts. So on Tuesday, we had the Cooperstown Casebook as a Crowning Compendium, which, like, that's a great title. And that's by Hardball Times' very own Paul Swiden. So in this article, he reviews Jay Jaffe's new book, the Cooperstown Casebook. And it provides kind of a deep exploration of the Hall of Fame, effortlessly combining the expansive relationship between its history and the statistics, that's not a difficult word to say, but it is for me, behind each of its inductees. So he spends a portion of the book walking readers through JAWS, which is his metric for evaluating players, and it combines their peak with their career into one score, and then it's obviously used to compare them to other pitchers or other players at their positions. So then the latter part of the book provides a detailed case for 14 possible inductees, ranging from David Ortiz to Mariano Rivera, and it covers at least one player from each position. And then he also talks about a number, I think it's like 250 other players. So Paul surmises that this is a must-read for baseball fans of all interests. So go ahead and give this article a read, and then go purchase the Cooperstown Casebook.
Yeah, so looking at Wednesday, we have More Than a Movie by Chris Gigli. On the 25th anniversary of classic baseball film A League of Their Own, Chris looks at what's changed and what hasn't changed vis-a-vis women's participation in baseball activities, both since the period in which the movie took place and since its 1992 release. The sad truth is that while there are more opportunities for women in baseball today, the amplification of people's objections has worsened with the advent of social media. You can scroll down to the comments of this article if you don't believe me. Chris then takes us to a celebration of A League of Their Own that took place this past June at League Stadium in Huntington, Indiana, which was one of the movie's filming locations. Festivities included an exhibition game between the Rockford Peaches and the Racine Belles, the players mostly being softball players from nearby colleges. They were in full costume, which, you know, looks cool, but doesn't work so well for playing, as it turns out. For more details about the event and to read Chris's thoughts on both historical and present-day sexism in baseball, you can check out the article on the Harbaugh Times' site. But as I mentioned, the comment section, it is... Yeah, there's a lot of opinions happening in there, and you know how we all feel about sexism, as in we are against it. So we disagree with a lot of the people who had things to say on this one, but you know, to each their own. Anyway, moving on to Thursday, we have Card Corner Plus, The Wonder of 1972 Tops Traded by Bruce Markison. In this edition of Card Corner Plus, Bruce looks at the 1972 Topps traded cards. Seven cards featuring players traded between the end of the 1971 season and the strike-delayed start of the 1972 season had the word traded stamped in large black letters across the bottom part of the card. As Bruce notes, this saved Topps the trouble of having to airbrush new uniform colors onto traded players or perform other tricks to obscure the team they were traded from. Bruce provides background information on the traded players, three of whom were future Hall of Famers, and lets us know what was going on with them and baseball in general around the time they were traded. As always, these are fun, insightful reads, so give this one a click. And then finally, on Friday, we have Memories of the White Flag by Eric Crouch. In his Hardball Times debut, Eric looks at an infamous 1997 trade between the White Sox and the Giants, in which a middling Chicago team dealt three major leaguers, including its best starter and its closer, for six prospects. Dubbed the White Flag trade, at the time, it was taken as a symbol of the White Sox giving up on a season when they might have had the talent to have a shot at competing that year. 20 years on, Eric examines the eventual outcomes of that trade.
And next week's articles include, on Monday, there is David Kagan on the physics of a rising fastball. Tuesday, we have Frank Jackson on keeping a score at games. Wednesday, we have Paul Mohringer's pyramid rating system, all-time Kansas City Royals. Thursday, there's me on players who have been accused of domestic violence and sexual assault and signing or re-signing with your favorite team. And then on Friday, there's John LaRue on largest games back deficits overcome with many pretty graphs. Thank you all for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times audio. You can find all the articles mentioned in this episode at hardballtimes.com, and you can find the site on Twitter at hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at JenMacRamos. You can find Sarah at SarahWexler32. You can find Mary at Mary M. Craig. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times audio on hardballtimes.com and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.